Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specking, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin. Press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your calls. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Welcome, everybody. That was the open for the podcast, but we're going to record a couple of bonus hours for the SiriusXM show. We are going to record 2 hours. We don't really do any commercials. I say I'm going to a commercial. We come right back. We do the next segment. And then when we're done with the first hour, even though I always say I'm done, I've got to get out of here, don't hang up after the first hour because we'll come right back and we'll record a second hour. And I'll remind you of that right before we go into that segment. Let's go ahead and get started. If you've got a question, a comment, a topic, anything you want to talk about, and you haven't already done so, press 1 on your phone. That's what gets you into the queue, so Lisa knows to screen your call. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs. Back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888-ROAD-DOG. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your own authority, whatever it might be, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. We're going to get to those calls in just a little bit. I post something about health care and health insurance, and it was a very specific post, and yet nobody really commented on what I was saying. Everybody just wants to talk about either why they hate Obamacare or why they love Obamacare. There doesn't seem to be too many people in the middle. I really wasn't interested in debating the details of Obamacare. The reason is I haven't found anybody yet who knows enough about the program to really debate it intelligently. It's a huge, widespread, wide-sweeping program with thousands of pages, tens of thousands, and regulations, and yet people try to oversimplify it, and they've done very little research. All they know, the people who are for it tend to just say things like, well, I like it because I got my insurance and I couldn't get any before. Yeah, that's a good reason to drag the entire country's economy down. But without getting into all that stuff, I made one simple point and yet nobody addressed it. And we're over 200 comments already. Nobody has addressed it, even though I've gone back 4 or 5 times and said, this was the point I was trying to make. Somebody addressed this point, yet nobody will. Here's the point. I hear people and I see people making the statement that they have a right to health care or a right to health insurance, now, or a right to be healthy. Now, those are three very different things. The first thing we have to do is figure out what it is we're talking about. Your health health insurance and health care, three totally different things. You, what you have the right to do in this country, you have the right to pursue a healthy life. That's it. You don't have a right to health care, and you don't have a right to health insurance. You can't have a right to those things because it requires somebody else to provide them. You can't have a right to something else, that to something that somebody else has to give to you. You don't have a right to anybody else's time, labor, intelligence, resources. You don't have any rights to those things. They have the rights to those things. They earned them, or they received them from somebody. You have no rights to what somebody else owns, including their intelligence, their time, their labor, their effort, their resources. You don't have a right to those things. And in order for you to claim you have a right to health insurance, that means somebody has to provide that to you. You don't have a right to force anybody else to provide you with anything. Now, you have a right to pursue a healthy lifestyle. We all do. Nobody's stopping anybody from that. You could exercise more. You could eat better. You could learn more. There are tens of thousands of things you can do to be healthier. Unfortunately, most people don't. That's a big part of our health care crisis, is because people don't take care of their own health. Look around. There are a lot of fat people. I'm not going to call them big or obese. There are a lot of fat people. And if that hurts, I'm sorry. Well, actually, I'm not. I'm not going to apologize for that. That happened because of your actions. Now, don't think for a second that I can't empathize with that. I can. But nobody can fix that except you. I can't fix it. The government can't fix it. Obamacare can't fix it. All the money in the world can't fix it if you don't do the right stuff. So we have people who are overweight, people who eat poorly, people who smoke, people who drink to excess, people who don't work out and get any activity. And I could throw myself into some of those groups, and I've admitted that before. But I don't do all those things and then go expect somebody else to take care of me. If I don't take care of my health, then I will pay the consequences for that. But that's where our health care crisis started. That's what keeps making it worse. People go to the doctor and they don't want to, doctors don't even try to make anybody healthy. So if you think going to the doctor is going to make you healthy, if you think having health insurance is going to make you healthy, you're insane and ignorant, because none of those things make you healthy. Doctors don't make you healthy. Doctors cover up symptoms. That's about all they do. Now, sometimes I don't blame them, because if doctors actually gave the best advice on how to make people healthy, people don't follow it. So what's the point? Doctors have learned what people want is a prescription and a drug to take to cover up their symptoms. So that's where the real health care crisis is. It's the fact that we don't have people who are willing to put in even a little bit of work to make themselves healthier. And yet they think they have a right to somebody else's time, effort, labor, resources. That's not a right. Now, we may have voted in laws. We voted in all kinds of laws that have nothing to do with the rights that are in the Constitution, granted not by a government. Rights are not granted by a government. Rights are granted by your Creator. And health insurance and health care, not one of them. So if you want to debate Obamacare or socialized medicine or whatever it might be, please stop saying that it's a right. That is absolutely incorrect. It's not. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Kansas. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Kevin.
What's on your mind today?
I got a scan gauge from you guys about a year ago, and I've got my mileage up. just under 8 miles to the gallon, 03W9, 6NZ, 355s.
Nice.
To maybe put a maybe looking to put a Pittsburgh power box on. Didn't know if that would gain me a whole lot. Looking to do maybe a turbo or a manifold or both. The turbo I got on seems to be working really good, so I don't know, maybe I should just do the exhaust manifold. And then looking to see, I got 1.5 million miles on this truck. Looking to see maybe if I should change my gears out and go into, you know, and what would be my best bet. I'm on Paul 22.5.
So a couple things. Yeah, a couple things. You've done a fantastic job with your mileage, no question. When you get up around 8 with a classic, that is fantastic. The manifold could help. I mean, all the things we talk about. It doesn't matter how good your fuel mileage gets. Physics are physics, and if we do something that improves the physics, and fuel mileage will improve with it. So the manifold and the turbo both reduce back pressure. So the turbo, a lot of people are confused about what we do when we change the turbo. All we're doing really is putting in a bigger housing. And that allows more air flow through the turbo with less restriction. Now, there's actually a little bit of a downside to that. Your turbo will spool up slower. So depending, if I were in an operation where I was heavy and had to pull a lot and had to get through the gears a lot, I wouldn't go with the bigger turbo, because it will actually make the engine work harder. But in most operations, we can go with the slightly larger turbo housing without really affecting performance and improve fuel economy. So both of those would work. And the thing about that is, if you're going to do them, it would make a whole lot of sense to do them at the same time, just because the labor cost is so much cheaper if you do them both at the same time. If you decide you're only going to do one, then, you know, just do the one. But if eventually you're going to do both, I would move it down the list until you could do both at the same time. That just makes sense. The gear change. This is a tough one because there's not a real quick payback on this. If you were going to change gears based on what you were doing, I would also change tire size. You know, I would go to low pro 22.5s. Or wide singles, the low pro wide singles, to get the lowest rolling resistance we possibly could. And then the best gears for you with that engine would be 264s to run in direct, or 279s, depending on how fast you want to drive most of the time. Hold that thought. I'll come back and see if any of those ideas helped you or not, and we can talk about it. We'll be right back. You're on the road, Doug. Sirius XM 146. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. If you want to talk about Obamacare health care, we can. If you can't get through and you want to talk about it, we've got a pretty lively conversation going on my personal Facebook page. In fact, I was just called a self-centered, egotistical asshole. I'm not sure if I should take that as a compliment or not. And, go join the conversation. It's getting interesting. There are some good points made in there, although nobody has addressed the issue of health insurance or health care being a right yet. Now there are people questioning what I'm doing to help anybody with this. Not sure that was my responsibility, although I do help a lot of people with these kind of issues. Let's go back to the phones. I was talking with Patrick in Kansas. So, Patrick, those things would all work. Like I say, the gear change, you know, depending. If you just have to go to a shop and pay for all of it, it usually ends up costing $4,000 to $5,000 to change gears, which means you'd have to pick up about 4 or 5 tenths for a break even in a year. And usually that doesn't happen. You pick up probably 2 or 3, and the payback ends up being, or the break-even ends up being, in about 18 months. So I don't consider that one a no-brainer. That one you have to put a little more thought and effort into.
Well, like this, the way this truck is feeding it, when I'm in a 55 zone, I typically set the cruise in overdrive. It's like 1197 at 55 in overdrive. And that's where I'm really getting a lot of good mileage.
Yeah, then I would probably leave it. That seems to be working well for you. If you were going to switch, the only real better gear you could choose would be a 264, which would put you at that very same RPM in direct. It's almost identical, right? Running 355s in an overdrive is almost identical to 264s in direct as far as the RPM goes.
Okay, and then you drop that, you lose that overdrive so you don't have as much drag in the transmission. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's where we pick up about 3% in fuel economy. If nothing else changes, the difference between you running in overdrive at a certain RPM or direct at that same RPM, the difference is about 3% because the gear is more efficient.
Okay, and we're in between an 80 and an 85,000 pound gross weight off-road station. One trailer typically tanks. Today I've got a bottle on hauling anhydrous. You know, so I don't get carried away anyway, because that anhydrous is pretty much a big target on the back of your head.
Yeah.
And pretty much, I mean, we're out here in the West, Wyoming, Nebraska, Colorado, Kansas, and I pretty much want to run about 68. Where is that, you know, on the big road, where is that going to put me? I don't really get carried away time-wise. I just want to make fuel mileage. So
right.
where is 68 going to put me in the big hole with a 264?
Well, you wouldn't even
get out of that.
Yeah, you would never get to – did you say it was a 13 or an 18 speed?
It's a 13 with an 073 overdrive.
Okay. So you would probably never get to 13th gear. 13th gear in your truck would be 100 miles an hour, or darn close to it. It would be every bit of 90.
Yeah.
12th gear you could use occasionally when you're in a hurry. But even 12th gear is going to be really fast. Because remember, we're going to make direct exactly like 13th is right now. That means you have two more gears. In each gear, we drop roughly, you know, 500, well, if we're splitting them, 250 to 300 RPM.
Right.
So you can see what that would do to 12th and 13th. They will become really tall gears.
Right. And so... what about, I don't think you addressed it earlier, and I'll let you go after this. What about doing a power box? With the way this thing is
going,
do I need to worry about any of that stuff?
Well, honestly, of all the things you mentioned, I think I would do the power box first. Because your operation being heavy, putting a lot of demand on that engine. See, a power box was something I never even bothered with in my operation. It just wasn't worth it. That we didn't put enough demand on the engine to need it, so it wasn't going to do us any good. You're at the other end of that scale. You're putting a tremendous amount of demand on that engine based on your weight and geographically where you are. So for me, the power box is an easy install. It's got a ton of benefits. You'll love driving the truck with it. It will improve fuel economy as long as you don't abuse it. So that would probably be the first one of those things I would choose. Let's go to Oklahoma. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
So good evening. Thank you for taking my call. I had an oil sample I wanted you to take a look at, and I had a couple questions on it.
Let's see. Looks good. It looks like your copper is still coming down, which is a good thing. I mean, we've always believed that the copper in your sample, it's always been high, but we've always said it's just coming out of the oil cooler. It leaches literally right out of the tubes, doesn't hurt anything, and we can see it dropping. As the truck gets older, then there's less copper available to leach out. So that's a good sign. It's still on its way down, and everything else looks good. Viscosity is a little high for a 30-weight oil, but nothing to be concerned about. Base has dropped a little bit, but you've got a lot of miles on this oil. I say just keep doing what you're doing.
Okay, that was my question. I was wondering if the base was getting down to where I needed to drain a little bit off and refill it, because it really doesn't use a whole lot of oil. Yeah.
If it drops again, I would wait till the next sample. Right now you still have plenty of base, and I'm looking at the history on the base, and really the last three samples, it went from 5.2 to 4.2, which was kind of a big drop, but then it went from 4.2 to 3.9. I mean, that dropped very little. So I would just wait till the next sample because you still have plenty of base. If it drops the next sample, give me a call, but you might just want to drain a couple gallons. Or on your next filter change, find the Luber finer filters with the base and just spin one of those on and it'll take care of it.
Yeah, it has a cartridge style, so I would love to do that, but it has two cartridges on it.
Oh, that's right. You've got a packed car engine. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so wait and see, and if we need to, you could drain a couple gallons. But right now, it's fine.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Arkansas. Donna, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I got a question. My truck, I have a 2001 Freightliner Century Class with a 10-speed. And it's starting to slip out of reverse when I'm backing up. It doesn't do it if I'm accelerating, but if I've just got my foot off the clutch and letting it roll back, you know, it'll roll back and then it'll just slip right out of gear. And I'm wondering what that might be a sign of, in your opinion.
I don't believe there's anything external that can cause this. There can possibly be some linkage issues, and I've even seen some cases where worn motor mounts, transmission mounts, and cab mounts. You get enough play in all of those mounts that it makes it possible for, if it twists a little bit, to pop it out of gear. I don't think that's what's happening here, though. The fact that it's popping out just at idle, And once you put a little fuel to it, you create some tension on the gear, and then it won't come out. But I don't know of anything external. Normally, when an engine or when a transmission starts doing this, it's usually time for a rebuild.
Yeah. Okay, and I have one more question for you. I changed, last time I changed my fuel filter, and I was kind of cleaning all just wiping out the inside of it, and getting all the sludge out, and I started pulling on what I realized was like the little netting that I guess, you know, is there to keep dirt from going into your, you know, going into the lines. What does it take to replace that, or what was it attached to? I didn't even realize what it was until I had it off. I just thought it was more of the sludge.
Hold on, because I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about, so let me get through this break. We'll come back. We'll try to figure this one out. Stick around. We'll be right back here on the Road Dog Sirius XM 146. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. Let's get right back to some phone calls. I was talking with Donna in Arkansas. Donna, are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So what? Tell me what kind of a filter this is. Is this like a Fuel Pro, like a Davco?
It's just, well, where it came from was, and maybe I'm wrong about what it was. Yeah, I mean, I have my engine is a 2000 Series 60, and up by where kind of the fuel intake is, you know, within, you know, the spin-on filter, I had that off and everything, and was just wiping out the bowl, and I started pulling on what I thought was just some sludge or dirt, but once I got it off, it seemed like it was like a black, stretchy, almost like a netting, like it would have been there to, like, covering something to keep dirt from going in or something. That's what I thought it was. But maybe I'm wrong,
you know,
about what
I,
it was.
I don't know what it is. Honestly, I'm not clear, and I don't want to try to answer this until I am clear. If I had either a picture of where you were working, like when you say the bowl, on a spin-on filter, that I'm – what bowl?
Well, okay, so if you took the spin-on filter, took the, you know, the top off, took the filter off, and if you were just to take, you know, where the fuel sits, if you just took a rag and wiped that out, where the little spout, for lack of a better word, on the right-hand side of it, as you're standing over it looking at it, it appears as though the intake is on the right, you know, where the fuel would go out and into the, okay, and right there where it picks up the fuel, right in there, there was, I'm trying to picture it myself now, where how it was,
yes,
caught up in there, but right up in,
I'm
there,
almost
it was like
wondering,
caught up in there. Uh-huh.
How many miles are on this truck?
A lot. Almost 2 million, about 1.75 million.
When were the fuel lines ever changed?
They have been changed. I didn't change them. And I've had the truck for over 700,000 miles.
Okay. You may be finding parts of deteriorated fuel lines. They
uh-huh.
deteriorate internally. On the outside, they can look great. On the inside, they can deteriorate. They can swell. They can get. They can split. We can get bubbles where it's, you get a little split in the lining, and then the fuel gets inside. There's all kinds of nasty things that I recommend changing fuel lines every 750,000 miles. So
okay.
Yours probably should have been replaced twice by now, and we're heading into the third time. I would replace every rubber fuel line on the truck. If you have any hard plastic lines or aircraft style, don't worry about those, but any rubber lines, replace them all. Good news is, you may see some performance and fuel mileage increase from this.
That would be a great thing. And can I ask you one more question real quick? Just, it's kind of on the topic that you were just talking to that gentleman about last.
Okay.
I right now I'm light most of the time, and I'm running coast to coast, so I spend a lot of time on flat land. But I'm thinking about, I live in California, spending a little bit more time closer to home, but that a few weeks ago, found myself running heavy in the hills, and I mean, my mileage took about a 3 mile per gallon swing. And so I was actually thinking about doing a power box, and how much would that help? I mean, it sounds like it would help a lot, but I want to get your opinion.
Yeah, it really does. Some engines respond really well to the power box. The Acert, which I think is a horrible engine, is improved tremendously from a power box. The pre-emission Series 60s, it's amazing how much power and torque those engines can produce and still get really good fuel economy. So the power box is kind of one of those, not necessarily something I recommend to people early in their fuel mileage quest, but when they get to that point where they've got their fuel mileage improved, and because they've improved their fuel mileage, now they've got some money and they're looking for something, you know, the next thing. The power box is nice. It makes the truck very drivable and can improve fuel economy as long as you don't abuse it. So it's not one of those things I ever tell people you absolutely should get one. It's one of those things that you probably want one. Let's go to Kentucky. Chris, welcome to the program.
How are we doing today, Kevin?
Good. What can I help you with?
I have your favorite truck. It's a 07-379 with a 550 C15 A-shirt, and I'm thinking about bringing it back, tearing the actuators, twin turbo, everything off it. Thought I'd see what you thought about that.
There is nothing better you can do to that engine.
All right, while I'm doing that, should I go ahead and put the OPS and fast system on it?
If you have the budget and those are things that are on your list, that's certainly the time to do it. Because, again, when we can combine multiple projects, especially when we're going to be in the same area, like a manifold and a turbo, I would hate to do those separately. You almost double your labor costs. So the OPS and the FAS, you wouldn't have to do them at the same time. You're probably not really going to save any money on labor with those two because the installation is going to be about the same.
Would you do the exhaust manifold at the same time, though?
The exhaust manifold I would certainly do at the same time, yes. That one would make sense to do at the same time. So if you had the FAS, the OPS, and the exhaust manifold on your list of things to do, but you said, right now I can only afford to do one while I'm doing this, you know, taking it back to a 6NZ, then the manifold would be the one because you'll save money on the labor where the FAS and the OPS, you could put those on any time.
Okay, if I did all that, I know this is an off-the-wall thing, and you don't get asked a lot, but if I did that, bring it back to a 6NZ and switch to synthetic, do you think I'd come somewhere around 3 or 4 tenths increase on fuel mileage?
Oh, I've seen as much. And you know me, I don't try to overstate claims on fuel mileage. I usually try to understate them. But
absolutely,
when on this type of a conversion, I've seen a full mile per gallon.
Okay.
Yeah,
now,
it's big.
Now, this motor still has about a year and a half of warranty on it, but I'm saying it'll void out the warranty, but do you think that it's worth that?
For me, it would be in a heartbeat. I know people, you know, like the comfort and security of having that warranty, so I don't like to talk anybody out of that, but what I can tell you is what I would do. That warranty, for me, is almost worthless. Getting this truck to run right and get really good fuel economy, that's worth a lot.
Yeah, because I got $400,000 on this rebuild, and I'm at 6.3 for the fuel mileage now. So if what you're saying turns out, I mean, it should be a 7 mile a gallon truck as far as I can see.
Absolutely. And like I say, I don't like to overstate fuel mileage gains, but this is one of those changes that makes a big, big difference in that engine. Let's go to Indiana. James, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. My wife actually called me when she read your post, and she did bring up the rights. So just so you know that people do feel the same way.
Good.
I got my glider 4 months ago, and I'm just going to touch base a little bit on this. My 30-day is 773, my 60-day is 770, my 90-day is 762. I'm real happy with the truck. So
good.
Shout out to Clark Power, who did my engine. My ring didn't. At 30,000, we scheduled it down. At 30,000, I took it in. 3 days later, I picked the truck up. I didn't pay a dime. I didn't even pay for the oil. Didn't even pay for the new filters. They didn't charge me any to change the rings. Great
That's
deal.
Excellent.
So,
that's the way it should be, and unfortunately, most of the time, it's not. So I'm going to compliment them, too, for doing the right thing. Hold that thought. I've got to get to the final break. I'm going to come back to you, though, so hold on. Stick around. We'll be right back here on the Road Dog Sirius XM 146. I'm Kevin Rothberg. All right, just a quick reminder, we're heading into the fourth and final segment of the first hour. So at the end of the segment, I'm going to say, we're all done. Good night. I've got to get out of here. Don't hang up, because we'll come right back after that, record the second hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. I was talking with James in Indiana. James, go ahead.
All right. Well, here's the real reason I called. I hauled to a customer. We've got one customer. They've got 30 to 40 trucks, and they haul their product to their customers. They've followed my fuel mileage quest from the beginning, because I made it an issue and everything else. Well, what I was finding now was I was not finding an ally within the company that would, you know, kind of get on board and try and, you know, take part in what I was doing and help themselves. Well, I finally had an ally. And he wears a polo shirt, so he's somebody in management that's, you know, got some influence. So he kept bugging me after I got the glider, wanted to see numbers. He said, wait 90 days. I said, I come in after 90 days. So I went in after 90 days. Well, he is on board with this whole idea, and he wants me to make a presentation, which is I'm all on board for that. I've been thinking all along. I would hope it would come to that. My real crux of it is to impress upon them, this isn't theory. This is real. This is what I have been doing. This is the results I'm getting. But what I want to do is introduce them to Let's Truck. There's a whole bunch of people out there doing the same thing I'm doing. There's a whole bunch of resources out there. And try and get them, you know, connected up that way. Talk about the people, the driver. Talk about the, you know, efficiency of the engine. Talk about the science of it all. But I also believe, because they love my scan gauge, when I show them how it works, they've actually went riding with me in the truck to see how this thing works.
Oh, good.
I think you know, that's a big plus for them to put them in their trucks. Would you guys be able to send somebody out and you know, like teach a class to their drivers to understand how to use the device to get the most out of it? And do you have any other ideas that, you know, could help me make sure I don't make a fool of myself?
Let me think. So where are they located? Let's start with that.
They're in Ohio.
Okay. I don't know. I don't travel for that kind of stuff anymore. I used to do, you know, seminars at the fleet level for a lot of reasons, and I got to the point where I charged what some people consider an outrageous amount of money only because my time's just valuable. I mean, we have a lot of projects. We're always working on something, and travel time is tough. You lose a day traveling there, a day traveling back, the time while you're there. I could certainly do a teleconference. We could do a class like that, a webinar kind of thing. And, you know, the scan gauge isn't all that complicated. I mean, I could easily, in an hour webinar, show them everything they need to know to make a decision about whether or not they would want to use the scan gauge or not. And then we would obviously provide support after the fact. So as far as the scan gauge goes, if they're interested, I would be willing to set up a webinar, and you know, I could probably get Jeff Zarley. Jeff's a busy guy too, but I could probably get him and the two of us in an hour could tell them everything they need to know and show them all the features and benefits and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
As far as you, here's what I would highly recommend for you, because you said you're going in to give a presentation, and that's really what you're doing. And that is intimidating. So congratulations on, you know, stepping out of your comfort zone and doing this. It's scary. I've been there. I had a horrible fear of public speaking for years and years. The good news is you don't die from it. And eventually it gets a little better. And then if you do it enough, I don't know that I ever fully get over that nervousness. I still get that way before a presentation, but it gets much easier. The thing that helps is be very prepared. Like, are you planning on using, like, presentation software, like PowerPoint, Keynote, something like that?
Yes, I am doing a PowerPoint. I've been working on the text actually before, you know, it ever came up, you know, what I wanted to say and back up what I'm saying with, you know, showing them I have the proof that I'm not making stuff up.
Let me give you a couple really quick lessons on PowerPoint that will make this go much better. The people, to me, in my opinion, take the easy way out with PowerPoint, and it ends up ruining their presentation and making it very difficult to watch. And what they do is they try to get everything down in writing on a screen, and then they stand there and read the screen. That's a horrible way to give a – yeah, you'd be surprised how many people fall back on reading what's up on their screen. Let me tell you how to give a good – PowerPoint presentation, or any, I use Keynote, same kind of thing. No more than 3 bullet points per slide. No more than 5 words per bullet point. So All I put up on the screen on a PowerPoint are a couple words to remind me what I was going to talk about. That topic, though, everything I need to say is in my head because I've practiced it over and over and over. And the PowerPoint is just there to keep me on track, because without the PowerPoint, I'd be wandering all over. But the PowerPoint for me, 3 bullet points, no more than 5 words each bullet point. Now, there are times when I'll put a screen up, it'll have 3 bullet points, 5 words per bullet point, and literally I'll talk for an hour and 15 minutes. Because it might be a topic that there's just a lot to talk about, but I just don't need many reminders. you know, if I step up and I want to talk about the physics of fuel mileage, and I've done that here on the air where I say, you know, in order to improve fuel mileage, you have to affect these areas, aerodynamics, rolling resistance, mechanical resistance, and engine efficiency. Now, I can talk about that topic for an hour with no bullet points at all. So the trick is keep your bullet points clean and simple, and then practice, practice, practice.
Which is easy to do sitting there behind the wheel going down the road.
Exactly. And that's how I got started. When I first started giving presentations and seminars, I was still driving, and I would practice all day long while I drove.
Well, I will say that the guy I'm talking to, he did say, you know, he right away recognized the potential savings, and he put a number on it, which is a little higher than I kind of guessed out in my mind. But he said, if this all pans out, he says, you realize, you know, you'll have saved our company a lot of money. He says, what's that worth to you? And I said, well, I'll tell you what's it worth to you guys? Because I'll be, you know, part of me is trying to cement a relationship with you guys. I believe in your company. I mean, I want to be this to be the last company I haul product to. And that's the driving force. I'm not going to turn down any financial, you know, reward you feel like you want to pass on. But, you know, believe me, the important thing to me is that this is going to cement a relationship that you know, for the future. So,
yeah,
who knows,
I'm
60 years old. Who knows, maybe in 4 years they decide they need somebody full-time working this part of the business for them, and, you know, maybe I'm ready to quit driving.
Here's the thing about this in the past. I've tried to get more people to do what you're doing. Go to the carrier, because a lot of people know way more about fuel mileage than their carriers do. And their carriers own all these trucks, and they could benefit from all this knowledge. And I've tried to get people to go back and do what you're doing. In the beginning, you've kind of got to volunteer your time. But it's worth it. You learn, they learn. And I think that if enough people did this, we might get some fleets to catch on, and they might actually make this a position. I think it would be a smart thing for carriers to do. It's the carriers I can't seem to convince. I mean, if you took somebody who really, really knew what they were talking about with fuel mileage, for a carrier to pay somebody like that, say, $60,000 to $75,000 a year would be peanuts. I mean, it would be so easy for you to save them 10 times more than that.
Well, I that's why I say it's taken a while to find the person that when I sat down and just touched base with him about what was going on, that right away recognized what kind of savings they're talking about. And now I got an ally. So I've nurtured that. I nurtured that for a few months, and now I got my chance.
Excellent. And that's what it takes. That's the kind of hard work people don't realize it takes. We will we'll be there right there with you. We'll help you out with this. I'd love to help out a company like that. So stay in touch and let me know what we can do to help you out. I'm all out of time. I've got to get out of here, but stick around. Jonesy's up next with the all-night truck stop. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 146. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rob. All right, don't hang up. We're getting ready to go right into another hour, so here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs. Back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rufford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your own authority, whatever it might be, you've come to the right place. Those are the kind of questions and many more we answer here on this show. And we're just going to get right to those calls tonight and answer as many questions as we can. Let's go to Alabama. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I've been trying to get my mind around some of the decision this company I'm working for now is making. I thought I'd get your opinion about what it might possibly be. We're about a 500-truck operation, 800 drivers, single owner, zero debt. We own just about a little of everything, it seems like, too, as far as trucks and trailers. If it's a manufacturing plant for automotive in the southeast, he has a contract. Dry vans hauling parts into the plants, flatbeds hauling equipment into the plants, specialized coil trailers hauling coils into the plants. We own a majority of the fleet, but he's got long-term leases, and he's also renting trucks and trailers by the week. And that I just can't get my mind around.
Yeah, you know what tends to happen sometimes, and I see this in business, and I see it in our own business. I mean, I could dig through some of the things we do around here and say, boy, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Sometimes it's just a matter of time and priorities. You know, sometimes we get into things for one reason, and then we continue them for another. So it's very possible he started doing the short-term leasing just to cover overflow, and he doesn't want to be too heavily invested in equipment that might end up sitting. So you've heard mm-hmm. me say many times, for a single truck owner-operator to go lease or rent equipment, especially short-term, is a nightmare. It's a horrible idea. But in a big company, sometimes those short-term leases allow you to rotate it and cover everything without being over-committed to equipment. So mm-hmm. it's kind of some of these things are going to be hard for me to answer if I don't have access to the whole mm-hmm. picture. But many, many times, businesses focus their time and energy on what works, and they don't realize they're missing lots of other opportunities. And sometimes mm-hmm. it's not necessarily worth it to go after the other opportunities. Even, and I know it's going to sound crazy me saying this, sometimes it's not worth it for fleets to go after fuel economy.
We don't.
Most don't. You'd be surprised. Very, very few fleets focus on fuel mileage. Now, I think more should, but sometimes, you know, for example, our company right now, we're in a growth stage. I mean, I just reviewed our last 3 years, and we are growing like crazy, which is a good thing. That's what companies want. We all want growth. But because we're growing so fast, now I look around and I see lots of things I'm doing wrong because I just don't have time. All I can do right now is manage the growth, and I don't want to slow that growth down. You know, while it's coming, while the work is there, while things are working, all I want to do is capture that growth. I realize I'm not monitoring and managing my expenses as well as I should. I could certainly do better in some of those areas. But now is not the time. The thing for me now, capture the growth. Once we stabilize some and the growth slows down, then I'll go back and start looking at the expenses and start cutting and managing better. Mm-hmm. So in general, that might be what's going on. It's hard for me to say, like I say, I'm not there. I'm not looking at the whole operation. But I see that happen a lot in businesses.
Yeah, I'd say about 95% of our runs are all dedicated runs too.
Yeah, and then there are other times where, you know, people never get around to doing that. I mean, I've seen businesses that have, you know, 20, 30 years, and they've left so much money on the table, it's not funny.
Yeah. Well, I know we're definitely leaving a lot of money on the table with fuel. They just, a year and a half ago, finally slowed the trucks from 75 down to 65.
Yeah, and
I think that was more insurance than fuel.
Yeah, but I bet they were pleasantly surprised what happened to their fuel mileage.
I'm not so sure if they saw it or not. I know there's a few people in upper management talk about how that they're convinced that a faster truck could still get just as good a mileage.
Oh, boy.
I can't. It's like, no, they're wrong.
They are wrong. Yeah. I've said this before. There are topics where we can certainly just talk about opinions. And lots of topics are that way. You have an opinion, I have an opinion. But then there are topics where there are just facts. And the fact is that it's all physics. You cannot go faster with less energy. You just can't do it. That's not logical, and physics says it's impossible. But I know. I see it all the time. Let's go to Illinois. Ken, welcome to the program.
Kevin, roughly about a month ago, the carrier that I'd been working with for the past 3 years was sold to another carrier, and obviously there's been quite a few changes. One of the things that they're telling us as of today is, along with our log pages and our bills every week when we send them in, we need to start sending in our fuel receipts because the DOT requires that. Have you ever heard of that?
I don't believe that there is a DOT requirement for fuel receipts. There's obviously an IFTA requirement for fuel receipts. But I don't, and the one thing, and I say this all the time, I do not stay up on compliance. Compliance is not my thing. It bores me to tears. I'd rather poke myself in the eye with a knitting needle than have to try to read compliance stuff. So, my opinion is on issues like this is worth about as much as somebody at the lunch counter. I just don't put much effort into learning and understanding compliance. I don't know of a requirement by the DOT for the actual fuel receipts themselves, but there might be. Here's the thing.
Okay.
Whether it's the DOT, the IFTA, or just the carrier, the carrier can say, hey, we want them. Part of the contract, we want them. So I don't know if it really matters why they want them.
Right. Okay. I appreciate it, Kevin. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Wish I had a better answer for you, but, I only have so much time to research, and I decided a long time ago compliance isn't going to be the thing I spend my time on. I'm trying to think if I can remember anything obvious or why the DOT. I know DOT, FMCSA, they will use fuel receipts, toll receipts, maintenance receipts. They'll use any piece of paper they can get their hands on to verify hours of service as well. Because remember, every time a receipt gets time stamped, time and date stamped, they could use that to match against logs and see if the logs are true or not. Let's go to Virginia. Daniel, welcome to the program. Let's try that again. Daniel?
Hello?
Yep,
Mr. Rutherford, hello. Hi. I talked to you not too long ago about an old truck that I saw, and it had an N14, a 13-speed with 390 rears. And I was wondering more about it, and I was trying to give Lisa the link to it, and I was not doing a very good job of trying to get everything linked to it, but I was trying to figure out if it's an actual good buy or should I kind of run away from this thing. So,
okay.
It's a 97 Ford LTL A9000, which is the Aeromax, with a red top N14 Cummins, and according to the thing, it's got 825-890 miles on it with a 13 speed. I can only assume to be 390 gears, considering that's what they threw in most of these. At one point in time, I had actually done a rig dig report on it and didn't find very much on it, but I guess what I'm really wondering is this something that could get in for a first truck or not?
Well, hold that thought, and I'll come back, and I've got a pretty good perspective on that because I had a 95 same model. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website, letstruck.com. Let's go back to the phones. I was talking with Daniel in Virginia. Daniel, refresh my memory. What was the price on this truck?
$7,900.
Yeah, this is a good starter truck. This is not a truck you're going to get overly excited about, unless, of course, it's your first truck, because first trucks are always exciting, no matter what they are. The N14 is a good, solid engine. It's capable of reasonably good fuel economy if we get it tuned and running right. We do all the other stuff. The AeroMax is a pretty aerodynamic truck, so we've got that's good. It's not a real comfortable truck. It feels like a work truck. The doors don't close nice and soft. It's not quiet inside when you're driving. Doesn't ride all that great. For me, it was, you know, when I look at all the trucks I've owned and the trucks I owned in the last 10 years or so, I really liked my Volvos because they held up well. They were quiet. They were comfortable. My Freightliners, not so much. And the Ford was actually a little worse than the Freightliner, believe it or not. It held up pretty well. It was just, it's not comfortable. I mean, it's not a really plush, you know, luxurious, comfortable truck. It's a work truck. That's what this thing is.
Yeah.
But for $7,000, you could make a bunch of money with this thing.
Now, the only thing is that now the truck has been, it's been sitting on truck paper for quite a bit. And, you know, just looking at pictures that are on it, that would be good. But I will say, it, just because I'm kind of particular, it would probably, just because the tires are mismatched, some of them are trailer tires, some of them aren't, opposition tires. And, I don't know, I'd probably want to get a nice set of they're duals on here, so if I was to go and spend money on tires, I really have, I kind of got a preference for the Bridgestone M710s,
Is this truck being sold from a dealer?
It's at a, let's see, yeah, it's a truck sales place.
So here's one of the things I do. I love when trucks have lousy tires, because that becomes a huge negotiation point for me. I'll walk around there. Once I decide that I want this truck and I'm close to buying it, then I'll go walk their lot and I'll find the tires I want somewhere else on their lot. Doesn't cost them much to switch them over. That's a great piece to negotiate. Here's the way. Now, if it were me, this thing's listed at 7. It's been in the paper a long time. this is like a redheaded stepchild. Nobody wants a Ford truck. Nobody's really excited about an N14. So this thing isn't moving fast, but I think it's got a lot of potential to make money. I would go in and I would start my offer at five. And I would negotiate to the very best price I could. Then when the negotiations are almost done, I mean, literally when the pen is in my hand and I'm getting ready to sign the contract, you put the cap back on the pen, you set it back down, and you go, I just can't buy this truck with those tires. But I was walking around on your lot, and I saw a set of tires I really like. Switch them now, and we've got a deal. I'll sign.
Kind of get them where they're drooling, and then switch
yep.
them.
That is a pretty classic negotiation tool. It's, you know, there's lots of different names for it, the last second strategy, all kinds of things. But we've worked out everything else. Everybody's happy. You're ready to sign. And then at the last second, you go, you know, there's one more thing I really need. And they are so much more likely to do it at that point than at any other time. But, yeah, this is a truck you could certainly make money with. Let's go to Idaho. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hello. I'm calling today. I want to find out how complicated is it to switch your commercial truck over to like a not-for-hire, you know, private RV status like you used to pull your toy hauler with. Is that real complicated? Or
It can be a nightmare, and here's why. Or sometimes it can be pretty easy. The problem is, and don't let anybody tell you that they know all the rules when it comes to this stuff, because nobody knows all the rules. I've been through this. The states and the agencies that you have to deal with, they don't know the rules. That's why this becomes fairly complicated sometimes. For example, insurance. Called my insurance company. I said, I need to insure an RV. They say, okay, tell us what year, make, and model. So you tell them it's a 99 Volvo, and they come back and say, but that's not an RV, that's a commercial vehicle. And I say, it's only a commercial vehicle if I use it that way. It's just a vehicle. It's not a commercial vehicle, it's just a vehicle. It's not commercial until I use it commercially. I'm not going to use it commercially. I'm going to pull my RV with it. 6 hours later, you might get an answer. Or you might get three or four answers. Yeah, so insurance can be an issue. When I went to put plates on the truck in Oregon, I went down to the license bureau. We're standing in line. We're trying to show that this is not a commercial vehicle. It's not a pickup truck. So the first person had no clue what to do. They went and got somebody else. 2 hours later, they decided they didn't know how to do it, told us to come back after lunch. Lisa stayed for another 3 hours. They got somebody that worked in the office for 30 years. They came over, couldn't figure out what to do. This is the kind of stuff you run into. Insurance and plates. Now, you might go to another state, and you might walk in, tell them what you're doing, and walk out 15 minutes later with plates. Every state is different. Everybody you talk to has a different answer about this stuff, and all you can do is just keep plugging away until you get it done.
Nice, nice. I got one more thing for you here on the talking your health care for the other issue there. I just want to give you a shout-out. Thanks for letting me know what a HSA is. I didn't know what a HSA was until I started listening to your show. Got a little money saved up, and I just find so many wonderful benefits in my position. And it's nice knowing that I got some cash on the side ready to go if there is a medical, you know, need.
Absolutely.
So.
You know, we haven't talked about that much lately, but the HSAs, I think, was one of the things that our government actually got right. It was a step in the right direction. And I complimented them on it over and over and over throughout the years. I've pointed lots of people to them. The HSA actually brings personal responsibility back to healthcare. Unfortunately, Obamacare has kind of gutted the whole HSA. It doesn't mean you can't have one anymore, It's a little more difficult. Not as many people qualify, and some of the better rules have kind of disappeared. But you're right. HSAs are a great thing. I had an HSA from 1997 all the way up until just recently because of Obamacare. Now I have to see if I can figure out how to get one back again. Maybe what I'll do is just try to get an insurance company to sell me one, and even if it doesn't qualify, I'll just pay the damn penalty. Let's see. Let's go to Virginia. Clint, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Glad I can talk to you tonight.
What's on your mind?
I want to talk to you. I have a 2005 Kenworth T600 with the C15 Acer, and the turbo 1700 RPMs is only pushing about 22, 23 pounds of boost. And I've talked to a couple different mechanics, and they can't really give me any ideas on why it might be so low.
Is this something new, or has it always been this way?
I've had the truck for about a year, and it's been this way since I had the truck.
Okay, so we don't know what changed, if anything, or when it changed. This has always been this way. Sometimes when things change, knowing when they changed and what else happened helps us troubleshoot it. But if we don't know that, we just have to start from scratch. Here's the first thing. Has anybody verified that the boost reading is correct?
We haven't verified the reading, but it's not a mechanical gauge. It's coming. I have the little Caterpillar in-dash display, the little computer they put in, and that's where I'm getting the reading from.
That's worse, because I would much, much rather see this from a mechanical gauge. And then, you know, we would know that it was correct. When it's an electric, when it's coming, or electronic, when it's coming from the ECM, there's lots of things that it could cause it to be incorrect, and it's much harder to test. A mechanical gauge, if we think it's wrong, you unscrew it, stick another gauge on it, you can usually figure it out. Hold on. I've got a couple other ideas, and I'll get to them when we get back. You're on the Road Dog Sirius, XM 146. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888-ROAD-DOG. The website.com. I'm going to go right back to the phones. I was talking with Clint in Virginia. Clint, you still with me?
Yes, Kevin.
All right. So what's the horsepower rating on this engine?
475.
So I think on an Acert, the Acert is different. We can usually calculate boost by horsepower, and it's not an exact science, but we can get pretty close. The Acert with two turbos, slightly different calculation, but I think you should be, on a hard pull, you should be able to produce probably 36 to 38 or maybe even 40 pounds of boost with that engine at that horsepower rating, maybe even a little higher than that. So if it's not, if your boost, that's almost cut in half. If that were a true reading, I think this engine would be running horrible and the fuel economy would be bad. Is that the case?
Well, the fuel economy is good. My 90-day average is 7.13, but it does feel like it falls right on its face anytime you try to go up any kind of a hill.
Well, the Acert will. and having the Acert set at the lower horsepower makes it even worse. I don't know that there's anything. I'll tell you what I would do, because it's so much cheaper than some of the other options trying to figure out what's wrong. The first thing I would do is I would verify that the boost is correct. I would put a known good mechanical gauge, you know, right into the manifold and measure the boost that way on a known good gauge. That's a simple, inexpensive way to figure out if we need to do anything or not. The other thing I would probably do, and most of the time on the Acert it's pretty simple, is I would turn it up to 550. That engine seems to run so much better when it's set at 550 rather than the 475.
Okay, I am planning on getting the Pittsburgh power box for it here, hopefully in the near future.
Well, and that has its own boost and pyrometer readings on it as well. So, you know, if you were thinking about going to Pittsburgh Power to get that done, they will certainly figure out the boost issue for you. They'll have that figured out in an hour. So if you're going to be going there anyway, let them take a look at this. But that's how I would approach this. I would verify that reading before I did anything else. Let's go to Amarillo. Mike, welcome to the program.
How you doing tonight, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind?
I got a little sample I want you to look at. It is my second sample since this fuel dilution showed up. I want to get your opinion on it.
All right. Let me take a look here and see what we've got. All right, so well, it came down, and you didn't change the oil. That's a good sign. It did come down a lot, but it's not all that high either. You know, we now consider 2 to be about normal. You were at 1.7 above that, meaning you're at 3.7. So it dropped down to 3.2. I don't know that I would do anything. I don't really see, are you using an additive like Lucas?
No, straight Rotella, D6.
Yeah, see, I don't think there's any real fuel dilution here because you're showing a viscosity of 16. That's actually high. And if we had any real fuel dilution, that viscosity would go down. The oil is being oxidized a lot. Do you have a lot of blow-by?
I've got some blow-by, but Tom, Tom called me and said that Rotella T6 shows a lot of high oxidation in their samples on that oil anyway.
Yeah, it does. It even shows oxidation right out of the bottle. It's one of the additives that they use that shows up like oxidation. I don't think there's really anything to worry about on this sample. I would keep doing what you're doing. I mean, I don't really see anything to change.
Okay. One thing that's got me is the last 2 months, my fuel mileage numbers have started dropping, and I can't
now,
quite
that's
figure
a concern.
It out. Yeah, that's why when I first saw that fuel dilution, it got me thinking, well, maybe I've got an injector starting to go bad. But then it turns around and drops.
How much has your fuel economy dropped?
I've lost at least half a mile a gallon.
Yeah, that's pretty serious. Yeah, and this is the time of year you shouldn't be losing fuel mileage. You should be gaining it. Because the weather's better. But I'm not seeing anything in the sample that would explain why. I mean, your soot is good. A little bit of fuel dilution. The problem is I'd hate to send you in and have you pay a bunch of money for injector work when I'm not completely convinced there's anything wrong. When was the last time the overhead was set?
The overhead would have been set January this year.
Yeah, I think I would just wait. Let's try to look for other things that could have caused the fuel mileage drop. I'm not seeing anything in the sample, and I don't know if it's worth it yet to go in and tear into injectors. So what I would do is hold off for one more sample, and then give me a call back. We'll take a look at it. Normally, when fuel mileage drops off, I can usually figure out why in the sample, and I'm not seeing it here. So it may not have anything to do with engine. There might be something else going on. You also want to look hard at your operation and just try to think, did anything change? Are you pulling different trailers, different weight, different part of the country, any of those things? Let's go to Iowa. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you doing tonight?
Good. What can I help you with?
Well, I've gone through about a week and a half spell here, and you can see it on fuel gauges. My mileage has dropped down into the sixes, where before it was in the sevens or a little better at times. And the only thing is I had a couple of loads that were, one of them I'm pretty sure was catching the wind. And this last one I think was a little heavier than they told me it was. But now I just filled up a while ago, and I've been in the sevens and actually nine just now, but I'm deadheading. But, you know, I'm trying to figure out. And my temperature on this thing has been up for the last 2 weeks running out west. My temperature gauge has been running over 200.
Yeah, heat is actually good for fuel economy. In almost all cases, the hotter the air gets, the thinner it gets. So aerodynamics get better when it gets hot. The hotter it gets, the thinner oils and lubricants become, which is a good thing. The hotter it gets, the more efficient the engine runs, which is another good thing. So typically, the only thing about really hot weather that tends to drive fuel economy down is the fact that people idle a lot more, run an air conditioner. But other than that, the heat should not be negatively affecting your fuel economy. What will, though, are those two loads you told me about. Certainly when things get heavier, our economy can drop off. But you've got a bigger challenge. Anybody with an open trailer, step deck, flatbed, any of those. And the challenge is every single time you load that trailer, you change the aerodynamics. And you can get some weird shapes on there that can create huge amounts of drag, and we wouldn't even know it. I mean, I wouldn't know it. I can't look at a load. I can look at some loads and say, well, that one's probably worse than the other one. But there are some cases where you can just create some horrible aerodynamics on a flatbed. So with just two or three fuel ups dropped off, I don't know if I would worry too much about it yet. I think I would wait for a little longer of a trend.
Okay, and what concerned me, too, is this thing is I've got one really bad pull when I go into Las Cruces. I've got a 7,500-foot summit with one heck of a three-mile grade on it, and this thing gets so hot that the shutdown light comes on and the temperature warning buzzer.
Yeah, now that is just, you know, we've talked about that many times, the older trucks, the deterioration of the cooling system over time. That's another issue. Like I say, the fuel mileage, I think I'd hold off for a little longer. Let's see if this trend continues or if we can get it turned around. Stick around. We'll be right back. You're on the Road Dog, Sirius XM 128. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to the phone calls. Let's go to Texas. Charles, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing tonight? One quick
good.
Compliment on being a grade-A asshole. That's pretty good there. I like being called that myself. I think everybody needs to step up, put their big boy britches on every once in a while.
That's right.
A question on the Cummins EGR stuff. Is it better to put the plate or completely delete it out of the system, on your opinion?
I think that the best results have come from the most extensive deletes. I mean, literally not trying to put Band-Aids on things, but getting rid of those parts and going back to the same part from the pre-emission engine.
Okay. All right. That's all I needed tonight, Kevin. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for the call. Yeah, I've seen lots of stuff in between. The in-between stuff, the quick fixes, the cheap fixes, the Band-Aids, I haven't seen really good results. I've seen very mixed results. Some people say it's working great. Some people say it doesn't work at all. The full deletes, literally going through the entire engine and going back to the pre-emission part, taking off anything that has to do with emissions, replacing it with the original pre-emission part, that works amazingly well. Those are the kind of fixes we've seen create a full mile per gallon. Now, I have to say it, it is illegal to deter the emissions in any way. Let's go to Tennessee. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, Kevin. I know we're going to run out of time, so I'll make it quick. You answered a lot of questions by saying, what would Kevin do? And this is going to be a solution as to what would Jerry do. Now, I want to make it clear that I have never had algae, don't ever intend to have algae, but if I ever had algae, here's what I would do, and it's a suggestion that I've never heard you approach before. You always say to dump an algaecide in there, and I would do that, and I would wait till I was almost home to my shop, and I would dump a real good algaecide in there. And then, having in a previous life, I've been around a lot of transfer pumps, fuel transfer pumps, and anywhere you buy a fuel transfer pump, you can buy a filter base. And I would make sure those tanks were down less than half, and I would suck it out of one tank, blow it back in the other, and filter it. Then I would stick the pump back in the other tank, and I'd pump that fuel back and forth about however many times it takes, half a dozen times. Standing there in the shop, you can change fuel filters extremely easy on that transfer pump. It kind of almost cleaned it up before you got back on the road. Now, why wouldn't that work?
It would. That's actually a good suggestion. And
well, then how come you haven't ever suggested it before?
Because I haven't thought of it. Now, the interesting thing is there was I should have, because I was out on a houseboat once. We rented a houseboat, Lisa and I. We were out on the houseboat for a week, and we got a horrible case of water in the fuel. I mean, in fact, it was so funny that when I pulled, we're out there, you know, floating around stranded on the houseboat, you know, had to throw the anchor out, and, you know, I'm trying to figure out what's wrong. So I pulled fuel out and put it in a glass jar. And I'm looking at the fuel in the glass jar, and I'm looking at it going, I don't know what's wrong. There's no water in this at all. Then it dawned on me. I thought there was no water. There was no fuel. I was looking at pure water.
Oh, my.
There was no – yeah, that's how bad the water got into the – wherever we got fuel or whoever fueled this thing, they got water so bad in their tanks that there wasn't even enough fuel for me to see the two different components. I was only seeing one, thinking it was fuel. Really, it was water. And that's exactly how we fixed it. I had somebody bring out a pump and filter setup from one of the marinas because they had one just like that, except theirs filtered it, recirculated it right back into the same tank. But we did that. We ran it through this filter system three or four times, got all the water out of it, and everything was fine. I don't know why that didn't dawn on me then,
Well, a lot of those transfer pumps, you could actually set them up with a series of filters. You could actually get a good water trap, and then you could get a good fine micron filter.
Yeah.
You could put them in series, and then standing there in the shop, it'd be a lot easier to change the filter and then keep pumping until it completely without having to change a filter. And you still might have to change one out on the road, but at least you wouldn't have to change it 6 or 8 times out on the road. And, you know, it's just kind of there's actually commercially available what they call a tank sweeper, and that's kind of where I thought of it, and I had never heard you mention it, so I thought I'd bring that up.
Oh, no, that's a great idea. I'm going to steal that idea from you and add it to my toolbox.
That's fine. No charge at all, so have a good evening, Kevin.
All right, thanks for the call. Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Like I said, I'm not sure why I didn't think about it, because I had to do that once before. You know, algae this summer hasn't seemed to, from my point of view, hasn't really been that big of a problem this summer. Last summer seemed to be horrible for algae. They had tons and tons of calls. This summer, not so much. But I love that idea. Now, the problem is, for most people, it would require a shop that had those capabilities. Most people aren't going to run out, buy their own transfer pump filter, set it all up. It's not very practical for a lot of people. So it comes down to, you know, I talk about the smoke test, and, you know, a lot of people want to get the smoke test done, but we can't find shops that can do it. This is kind of the same thing. This would go along with some of the other things that we've developed over the years around maintenance, so I want to add this one. Thank you for that. Let's go to Chicago. Tony, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, I have a tire question for you. I'm looking to switch over to the Super Singles, and it's the Michelin X1 Energy that I want to get. Is that correct?
You can get the X1 Energy if you can still find them, and it's a good tire. It's the X1 XDA Energy, but
okay.
It's been replaced. The new tire, Michelin kind of changed their naming. Now they distinguish the tires by they have their X line, which is their dual tires, and they have their X1 line, which are their wide singles. So would look for the X1 line, and they call the tire the Energy D. That's the new tire that has replaced the XDA Energy. It's longer lasting. I think they did give up a couple points in rolling resistance, but it's still very low, down in the high 80s, I think. So you may still find some XDA Energies, and that's a great tire, or you may find that you're going to see the X1 line Energy D instead.
Okay, and then the rims, I found a set of four for $600. Is that a pretty good price?
Four rims for $600?
Yeah, with a zero offset.
Now, you didn't find those. If you buy them, you stole them. That's a great price. That's less than half.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I was very, very happy when I was able to buy rims for $400 a piece through FedEx's national discount.
Mm-hmm. That zero offset is what I want to get. Is that correct?
Yep. The zero offset always works. So, yeah, that is the better way to go.
Sounds like a plan. That's the way we're going to go.
All right. Sounds like a winner. Thanks for the call. Looks like we're going to have to wrap this up. I am just about out of time. I do want to remind you that the Let's Truck web store is open. You can get your apparel there, shirts, hats, thermals. Not too many people looking for thermals this time of year, but it's all available up on the store. The book, audio, video program about how to get started as an owner-operator. It's titled Stop Holding the Steering Wheel and Start Driving Your Business. That's also back in the store. We were sold out of that book for several months. That is available again. So check that out. And the store is letstruck.com/store. Or you can always give us a call. There's always somebody willing to help you out on the phones if you need it. That number, 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. Thanks for joining me. We will see you back here again next time. You're on the Road Dog Sirius XM 146. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work. And master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.